Hello and welcome to Always Record, a production of SyncBook Radio and thesyncbook.com. Today is March 14th, 2013, and this is episode 41. We're going to be discussing some material that was found by Andras Jones. He's an actor, author, musician, the host and creator of Radio 8-Ball, and the author of Accidental Initiations from SyncBook Press. We will be joined, as always, by Bill Klaus from ayahuasca.blogspot.com and David Plate from beingthere723.blogspot.com. We're pleased to be joined, in addition to that, by John Fell Ryan, who writes at kdk12.tumblr.com. And he has been featured in the recent documentary Room 237. And we also are joined by Mark LeClaire, the Wrong Way Wizard. He writes at wrongwaywizard.blogspot.com. We're going to jump into a bunch of material here in just a moment. There is a particular link that we're going to be discussing, a particular list of events we're going to be discussing that I have linked up in the show notes, so you might want to pull that up and even skim over it before we start. Thanks so much. Enjoy.
How does she walk to the end of a pier in so many movies? And how does she break so many mirrors in so many movies? I don't get it. It's weird.
I wonder, do these actors notice this stuff when they're doing it over and over and over again? Any opinions on that?
I can say for myself that when it took Will Morgan to point out several things to me that should have been obvious, but weren't. So I think, I don't think for the most part we do notice that, unless someone comes along to point it out to us. I'm sure it's just a thing of it just, for me, it just like no one, I don't think, wow, there's a ton of redheads. How come I keep getting cast with redheads? Yeah. But Will Morgan's looks at it as like, oh my God, you're constantly surrounded by redheads. Just lucky, I guess, you know.
Well, like a forest from the trees kind of thing. Like you're in it, and so it's hard to see it. It's probably very common.
Yeah.
Like I have to wonder at what point. So like the actor who's, they're focused on bringing the character to life, but does the writer / director, at what point are they conscious? Like, you mentioned Jennifer Connelly and walking to the end of Piers, right? Like in the movie Dark City, what struck me, I don't know if this is an intentional pun or not, but the main character's name is Murdoch, right? Mur being the sea, right? This is La Mer, this is the sea. And Doc, and where does, like, so at the end she meets Murdoch, or, you know, the aquatic Doc, at the end of a pier, which is also known as a dock. And I'm like, is this like a sort of play on words? You know, take a long walk up a short pier. I don't know what is what exactly is the sort of you know, the intentionality there or not, or is it some sort of play on words? But I don't know.
I have an opinion on that if you want to hear it.
Yeah, please.
Well, it's interesting that you brought up Dark City, because we're going to discuss Kubrick. And I think that it plays in. I don't know if you guys, somebody needs to mute their mic there, who's typing. So I think it plays into the idea of the Archons. I don't know if you guys have been following Sean Fellas, this guy who's analyzing Kubrick right now. Anybody?
He's the bear, subliminal bears?
Yes, yes.
I had a dream last night that I was being chased by a giant fucking bear, and I realized that I think I've fucked with Kubrick's ghost or something. Sorry.
You might have. No, that's okay, because the idea of the bear having to do with Russia and then therefore equaling the Reds, right? As Andrus points out, there's something to do with the Boston Red Sox that seems to pop up over and over again. And I noticed that you actually put Reds in quotation, kind of making the communist implication as well. But anyway, back to this idea of Dark City and the Murdoch thing. What we have, the final image of Dark City is a symmetrical look straight down that pier, right? She's at the end of the dock or the pier, standing with Murdoch, and the sun is rising exactly in the middle of the screen at the background, okay? This is the exact same image from 2001 that we see after the monolith first appears in the Dawn of Man sequence. And what we see, the monolith, as if we're looking up towards the top of it, like laying down at the bottom, looking up towards the top. And directly above it is the sun. And when you see this image in 2001, you'll realize that the shape of the monolith is, it, you know, because of perspective and vanishing point, it looks like it's narrowing. It looks like a road almost going up the middle of the screen. And this is the exact same image as at the end of Dark City. And I think it's interesting because in terms of the bear, the Reds, and taking it further, because you use that cover of Time War, right? Right, well, it's time, and then it says war, but does it mean time war? Like, does it actually mean, you know, does it mean that there's some kind of war going on in time? I think it does, and I think that this is directly associated to the Archons, or the, you know, the old ones, the or something like that. And also, this is where it gets tough, because there's this strong communist theme that runs through it as well. I don't know if I've made myself clear here or not.
I think so. I mean, David wrote here as, you know, pyramid, like, you know, the idea of pier and pyramid. And I get what you're saying. So this idea of, with that vanishing point, it looks like a capstoneless pyramid. It's essentially the eye of Providence,
yeah.
Both in the pier, or dock, the pyramid in the middle,
yes.
And obviously the monolith. But when you said, as far as it looks like a road, and now you've got me thinking of The Shining, right? The Shining starts off with going to the sun road. It's essentially the same
beautiful,
thing,
beautiful.
Right?
Yes,
the road
absolutely.
To the sun.
Well, okay, so if we take this idea of the pier, I don't know if you guys, if any of you own a copy of the Golden Dawn Hermetic book.
Yeah.
You do? Okay. Well, if you've seen the cover of it, it's got the two triangles, one pointing up, one pointing downward. One of them is orange and the other is blue. And it clearly shows a sun rising over the water, basically.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so, that's, I'm just going to jump in here for a second, because I want to get us sort of settled. Is the orange and blue are the covers of the Mets baseball team. I'm not a baseball fan, but I only know this because I grew up really, really close to Shea Stadium, so I would see this every day. And Andres and I had a conversation about, like, this is where the Beatles have their big concert and things like that. So you have the Beetle, the Scarab Beetle, that carries the dung ball, the going to the road sun, that, of course, Jack Torrance drives that yellow Beetle up. Well, where do the Beatles make their big splash concert? But at Shea Stadium, it's not there anymore, they've demolished it, but it was all blue and it's covered in orange lettering and orange designs. So you have this same idea where the Beatles make their big splash.
Well, this is an explosive idea because there's a lot here having to do with the pyramids. Again, thank you to David for pointing that out. What we often forget about the pyramids is that they're tombs, right? They're a place where dead people are kept.
Actually, in the Egyptian pyramids, no one was actually ever found. What they found was sarcophaguses that were completely sealed up, and the tops of them weighed tons. And there was no the entrance when they found those sarcophaguses had to be blown up with fucking dynamite. The pharaohs and the kings were all buried in the Valley of the Kings, which is close by. But there's a mystery around if the sarcophaguses were not for mummies, which there is never a mummy found in a sarcophagus in a pyramid. But the Mexican pyramids are different. They did find skulls at the bottom of them.
We're talking about some kind of a vessel for some sort. I'm taking it back to the Archons again. And just to tie for listeners, the reason that I brought up the Archons in general is because that's the theme of the movie Dark City, basically, that there are these invisible
very
creatures.
Dark City is explicitly Gnostic.
Yeah, it is. So you have this idea then, what if that's what the pyramids are, as a vessel for the Archons? So we're not talking about the dead in quite the same way as we are talking about a dead human body, per se, but we're talking about something that operates from the spiritual realm, more like a ghost, basically. That conflation of the idea of the pyramids as tombs and as a vessel for some kind of ghostly power, essentially. So, you guys can run with this.
Well, where would the mystique and the power of the Egyptian culture be right now without those pyramids? I mean, that's something simple and basic that anyone from any culture can look upon as one of the great wonders of the world and say, I don't know much about, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, but those motherfuckers were doing something pretty important. It kind of just maintains their resonance throughout time. So in keeping something very old still alive, they work on a very, very basic level in that way.
Yes, and, if we're going to get into pyramid mythology, it's worth pointing out that it would be a practical impossibility using the most advanced construction equipment that exists today to build the pyramids. They still haven't figured out how it was done. And our equipment today is not made to build and move things that are that heavy, those blocks, with the kind of accuracy that is present in the pyramids. I mean, it is a perfect creation in so many different ways in regards to, its proportion and the shafts that lead out that you can see Orion's belt from at an exact certain time. So, I mean, we're talking about something that's pretty astounding here. And that things continually lead back. I know we're supposed to be talking about Kubrick today, and I can't help but think about Napoleon and his fascination with the pyramids. Napoleon claimed to have spent a night sleeping in the Great Pyramid.
I think it's interesting that we sort of started up this way. And Andres, I want to give us the proper sort of leaping off point so people listening can follow along.
I mean, I know it's always record, and you begin by digressing and then get to the point a half an hour in.
No, I'm all for that.
But what I want to say is I think this is interesting that we started this way only because last night I was sort of contemplating something that, like Jason Barrera has pointed out, where you see the one of the opening shots of Clockwork Orange, where you see them under the bridge, and this is very much an illuminated pyramid. If you watch that shot, the way he used the perspective and the cobblestones on the floor with that light in the background, it is an illuminated pyramid. When Alex is in the getting the Ludovico technique, the way the chairs are set up, those brown chairs, again making bricks, leaning up to the projector point, he plays with the eye in the pyramid, this illuminated pyramid. So I just think it's interesting that we wanted to talk about Kubrick and sort of ended up talking about this imagery, which I was late last night, I was sort of really pondering like his, almost to an extent, an overuse of this symbol, which seems, I don't know, I guess from my jaded alt conspiracy research mind, an over, like an almost cliche image at this point, but fascinating. All right, let's do this. Let's do this right though. Because we could digress, and I think I'm sure we will continue to do so. But I want to bring anyone who's listening along, I want to bring them into the sort of overarching, or perhaps it won't even be, but the starting off point that we are all coming from. You guys know I've been writing a book, Suicide Kings, and I'm focusing on these different assassinations and the king kill, things like that. So something that was very interesting to me is that we have these Kubrick release dates that seem to coincide with these big events. There's something for 2001 A Space Odyssey is released the exact day that Martin Luther King gets shot. Eyes Wide Shut comes out the exact day that JFK Jr. dies. And there's also, I found from Times, it was funny, we keep talking about these Time magazines, from Time magazine there was an article about Dr. Strangelove. When Dr. Strangelove was first, the first day Dr. Strangelove was shown to the press, it was shown on November 22nd, 1963, the day JFK was shot. And there was so much, these weird, awkward things that are mentioned in the movie that seemed to coincide with the assassination, that they actually ended up pushing back the release date and cutting out different chunks from it, little snippets out of it that seem to coincide. And you can read this little snippet of the article as well as the material that Andras put together, because I was discussing these three connections in particular with Andras, and he said, well, okay, those are the obvious ones, but what about the less obvious ones? Or let's take a look and see what else happened on the days that that these movies came out, that Kubrick movies were released. And Andras decided then to dig into that, and he put together a list, which you can find. I will, of course, link it up in the show notes. If anyone's listening to this at a later date, I have it up on my blog. It's allthehappycreatures.blogspot.com. It's March 2013, and the post is called A History in Kubrick by Andras Jones. That's how you'll find that. But I will, of course, link it up. If you're going to listen to today's show, I recommend kind of pulling that up now, and maybe you can follow along a little bit. And I'm gonna hand this over to Andras to kind of introduce what he found, because there's so many weird tangents that we can run down with each of these little nuggets that I think maybe just giving a quick overview of some of that data might just send us off for the next 4 hours. So,
okay. Well, so yeah. So I thought that the synchronicities that Alan found were obviously huge. And my experience of sync is that when you find the huge syncs, then if you find the system that they all fit into, you can find a lot of other maybe not so huge but equally mind blowing ones. So using IMDb and Wikipedia, I just went through and found the release dates and did a basic Google search, wiki search for the things that happened on those dates that are, you know, available to us and through that medium. And I also found the song that was the number one song that the week that film came out, because I always find that there's something interesting. It's where I come from because of Radio 8 Ball. There's something profound that music can do in the realm of sync. So just sort of, I'm going to work backwards from the last film through the first and just give a quick some of the highlights for people who might not be able to bring up the information online listening to this. So like, as Alan said, the last film that Kubrick did was Eyes Wide Shut. And that was the day that JFK Jr. died in his plane crash at sea. The number one song that week was Bills, Bills, Bills by Destiny's Child, which Alan pointed out was something I hadn't noticed. And I'm sure you guys are going to catch a bunch of things that I didn't see. But Tom Cruise's character was Bill in Eyes Wide Shut. Moving back to Full Metal Jacket, that came out on June 26, 1987. And it was actually a pretty slow news day. The biggest thing that shows up in the news for that day was that the Red Sox lost to the Yankees in a thrilling upset. They were down 9-0. The Yankees were down 9-0 to come back in the 11th inning and win. If you're not a baseball fan, that's not entirely important, except that, as we were talking about before, the Red Sox and the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry shows up several times along this Kubrick timeline. So it becomes something that's worth looking at. And again, Alan pointed out the battle between Yanks and Reds is deeply encoded into Kubrick's work and into that time. The number one song that week was I Want to Dance with Somebody by Whitney Houston. And Alan has done some work with Whitney Houston's stuff as well. Moving back, The Shining comes out on May 23rd, 1980, during the Mount St. Helens eruption. And that is the large event for that week. And the number one song is Blondie's Call Me. I'm going to just keep going through. I don't want to hit every point because I'm sure you guys are going to have a ton of stuff here. The most anomalous one of these is Barry Lyndon, which came out on December 18th, 1975. And I really could, like, as I searched around, there was no interesting news that day. I'm sure there was something interesting that happened that day. I was just unable to find it. Again, maybe you guys will find something, but Casey and the Sunshine Band's That's the Way I Like It came out that week, or was the number one hit that week. And I do think that there is something there with Barry Lyndon and the Sun King, and there might be something there. This is where it starts to get really interesting. And I have a theory about this, because they're more, I think, pure works of art than pop entertainment, they're less connected to their time than the films that preceded it. So we go back to Clockwork Orange, which was much more of a piece of pop art of its time, although also a great film. Number one song that week was Sly and the Family Stone's A Family Affair. And I find the most interesting sync in this whole exploration was what happened also on that day. A company called Intelsat launched an Atlantic satellite, Intelsat 3. And as we study or read about this company, Intelsat, which began as a government organization, is now a private company that runs a lot of the satellites that ring our world. They were a part of a snafu that happened during the Apollo 11 mission that threatened the ability to deliver the images from the moon back to Earth, which, considering everything we know or think we know or suspect about Kubrick, is very interesting to me. We'll also see that throughout Kubrick's career, there's rocket launchers and missiles going off all over the place. When 2001 was released, aside from the assassination of Martin Luther King, NASA launched the Apollo 6, the second and last unmanned test flight before manned test flights. And then moving back to January 29th, 1964, and the official release of Dr. Strangelove, we find that the number one song that week was There I've Said It Again, Bobby Vinton, which is only interesting really in the sense that it's the last pre-Beatles single that was a number one hit. We also find that another Apollo 1, the unmanned Apollo 1 Saturn launcher test attains Earth orbit on that same day. And Alan Ladd, the actor who played Shane, died, which is a sink of personal interest to me and maybe interesting to others. Moving to Lolita, Kubrick's first film in the UK, released June 13th, 1962. The number one song in that week is Ray Charles' I Can't Stop Loving You. It's also the day that Lee Harvey Oswald returns to the U.S. with his wife and daughter after spending 2 years in the USSR. And that meeting is well documented in the annals of conspiracy research. Also, just particularly interesting that it happened on that date. Moving quickly back in time, we now find ourselves at Spartacus, which came out on October 7th, 1960. The number one songs that week was My Heart. It was a tie that week. My Heart Has a Mind of Its Own by Connie Francis and Mr. Custer by Larry Verne. And we're going to find that Native American, like the theme of Native Americans shows up throughout this as well. Interestingly, now this was a hot date, a hot, hot date. This was the day of the second Kennedy-Nixon debate, the one where Nixon seemed all sweaty and shifty-eyed and lost the election, at least as history tells us, the way it went down. That was the day that Route 66 premiered on TV. It was the day that the CIA prepared its poison cigars for Castro. And we have Nigeria being admitted as the 99th member of the UN and a typhoon in the Philippines killing 51. I find it kind of interesting that Route 66 and Nigeria being the 99th member of the UN, that's all on the same day. And so we're getting a double 69, which is always fun. So then I'm going to try to take us back as fast as we can through time to December 25th, 1957, and the release of Paths of Glory. The number one song that week was Pat Boone's April Love, a very boring song. Enough to make you, and the song's so bad it might make you want to kill somebody. And interestingly, the interesting historical event that day is that Ed Gein, the first celebrity murderer, really, was found guilty and declared insane, beginning so many film franchises out of the which takes us back to May 20th, 1956, and The Killing, the recent release of The Killing. The number one song that week was Heartbreak Hotel by Elvis Presley. I find it interesting, and I think it's particularly interesting that as we follow the music, we see Kubrick right there, his films coming out at times when the whole landscape of culture was going to change through music. So he syncs up with not only the Beatles, but with Elvis. And I've been reading about him, and he also, one of his earliest photojournalism assignments that he gave himself when he was in high school was photographing Frank Sinatra when he would perform in New York City. Again, putting him right at the edge of this shift with music and culture. In 57, when The Killing was released, we have another bomb. We have the Operation Red Wing shot Cherokee, where the U.S. detonates a hydrogen bomb over the Bikini Atoll, and the death of Adolf Hitler's brother, Alois Jr., his older brother. I find it interesting. We have a bomb and we have the Operation Red Wing and shot Cherokee, amplifying the connection with the Native American imagery. And moving back to The Killer's Kiss, his first sort of large theatrical release came out on September 28th, 1955. The number one song that week was The Yellow Rose of Texas by Mitch Miller. If you listen to it, it's hard to believe that could have been a number one song, but it was. And that says how much, it shows how much music and culture is changing during this. On that day was the first color broadcast of the World Series. The Brooklyn Dodgers beat the Yankees, and the premiere of a show on CBS called Brave Eagle. And it's the first TV show with a Native American lead character who is played by Keith Larson, a man of Norwegian descent. But still, we have TV explosions in technology, and again, this running theme of America, sort of America's darkest chapter, the genocide of the Native American peoples. Now we move into his earliest films. He had, I mean, you may say that he had some control over the release dates of these later ones, but these earlier ones, which are shot through with syncs, he had no control over the release dates, I'm sure. His documentary, The Seafarers, came out on October 15th, 1953. The number one song that week was a Stan Freberg parody of Dragnet called St. George and the Dragonette. Can't wait to hear you guys unpack that one. The sync events that happened that day, it was the first televised weather report. The British test their first nuclear bomb, Totem 1, at Emu Field in South Australia. And John Patrick's Tea House of the Red Moon premieres in New York City. Moon imagery, more bombs. It's always an exciting day when Kubrick releases a picture. March. We move back to March 31st and his second picture. It's a film called Fear and Desire, and the number one song that week was Patti Page's Doggy in the Window. And the sync event of that day was the funeral of England's Queen Mary, coincided with the release of Fear and Desire. Now we move back to his earliest film, Day of the Fight, came out on April 26th, 1951. That also happens to be a day that the Red Sox and the Yankees met in a baseball game. So we have the Red Sox and Yankees showing up at the end of his career and also here at the beginning. And as a baseball fan and a Yankee fan from New York, he would have been to, you might have even have listened to that game on the radio, although he was probably busy with his film coming out. The number one song that week was How High the Moon by Les Paul and Mary Ford. And when I saw that, I couldn't help but get a huge smile on my face. And if you listen to it, it's an amazing song. I'd never given it any attention before, but it comes out in 1951. And the kind of vocal multi-tracking that they're doing sounds like Electric Light Orchestra, except this is 1951. And Les Paul looks more and more like a time traveler to me. The other big sync event that happened that day was that there were five tornadoes that struck in a town called Liberal, Kansas, on the border of Colorado, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Kansas. And there were no human fatalities. But again, we had sort of like the Mount St. Helens here. We can tie this back to these tornadoes. There's so much more to go into here, but this is the outline. I encourage people to go look at it online, and now I'd love to hear where you guys want to take it.
Well, I'll jump in. This is really fantastic work, first of all, so I'm blown away by it, quite frankly. And hearing you talk about it, is actually better than reading the article, because you highlight it in a gorgeous way. I'll tell you what I think this is. There's a certain theme that I see throughout this that you've laid out. And to me, maybe A Clockwork Orange is a good place to start. There's so much detail in what you just said. What were the details about A Clockwork Orange? That's
A Clockwork
I'm just scanning down to it now.
Clockwork Orange is a family affair and the
Intel
staff.
Yes. Okay, that's a perfect place to start.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, with the Intel stat, when I look at that, I'm like, I can't help but think, okay, if the theory is that Kubrick was the guy, was the guy they brought in to fake it, and if he's not just faking it, if he's just shooting a fake so that we can see it, the reason for doing that might be because this, because of the failure of this Intelsat satellite, making it impossible to get the images back from the moon to Earth. So you would have to hire someone to fake that. And it might, and it makes it, when I look at this, it makes it look more like, oh, this isn't some, you know, nefarious, like well thought out conspiracy. This is someone making a call at the last minute saying, holy fuck, we need to put something together. Who can we get? It's like wag, it's like wag the dog, you know, like, oh, something went, you know, we had a malfunction. Now we're going to need to do, we're going to need to fake it.
Interesting.
Well, for me, you know, I think that, you know, if they had to change one line in Dr. Strangelove because it referenced Dallas and they figured the whole nation would get upset by that, and they had to alter some other stuff in that movie and push back the release date because they said the synchronistic occurrence of these events in this movie will doom the movie, will hurt the public, and probably hurt the movie studio. If they were that concerned over, you know, just this little dark comedy, you think they were going to take a fucking chance on a live shot of the most powerful country in the world sending up astronauts to the moon and having something explode or having something go wrong? The public relations nightmare would have been colossal. So if they had this much paranoia over a simple movie, then you just transfer that over to making history, and I think that they're going to control the situation as much as possible. So that's my particular read on it. But I do like the way that the Intelsat folds in on that as well.
Well, I mean, I'd like to take this to the, you know, to the lunar stage, basically, right away, because to me, almost everything what Kubrick was saying in his films is imbued with information about the moon, that this is an undeniable fact, essentially. So, and okay, the Intelsat thing, Andres, you mentioned how that was a part of what we now call Star Wars, right? The whole setting up of a matrix, essentially. And, you know, we know whether or not it's a fictional matrix or whether it's real and it's really up there, that we're being given information that it's extremely sophisticated right now. Like, for instance, you know, you can presumably read a credit card from space or something along those lines, essentially. This has been portrayed in many films, including Wim Wenders' The End of Violence, too, which in which people just get shot out of the sky, basically, when they commit a crime. So we have this idea of the Star Wars, then, and we have this idea of it completely, and because this is associated with Clockwork Orange, to me this is really important. We have the idea of the world being in a net, essentially, okay? Because obviously, from any point up in space, we can presumably look down on the Earth and see what's going on. It's the eye of God in a certain respect, and a part of the reason that that we don't make the connection is because it's a spherical thing, right? But it's really just it's the pyramidical thing, too. Okay, so just stick with me here because I think I'm going to get to my point. I'm so excited right now about this stuff. I'm just practically shaking, quite frankly. So, if I seem a little bit off kilter, that's the reason why. So anyway, okay. So if we think of it in terms of a Clockwork Orange, we can see how there's a clockwork essentially that's now surrounding the Earth, basically, you know, mechanizing the viewpoint of reality, essentially. So, and this fits in with the idea of the pyramid for really important reasons, because, for instance, the character Bill Watson, right? Well, that could be translated into what's on the bill, right? And what's on the bill is the pyramid with the eye at the top of it. And, you know, you can take that bill thing further into Eyes Wide Shut, in which the character is looking for his wallet. And, of course, they mention a bill right away, like a doctor's bill, and of course his name is Bill. So you have this idea of and the idea of physical money is finally brought, you know, is really brought out into the open in Eyes Wide Shut and The Shining too, in those two films.
Bills, bills, bills.
Yes, exactly. Hmm. Bill, it's an extraordinary thing that you've stumbled onto here, Andres, but like I really think I know exactly what's being said here. So we have this idea of A Clockwork Orange, right? Well, where does Stanley Kubrick make his home? He makes his home in the UK. And we know that the House of Orange is the established government of the UK going back into antiquity, right? So this all has to do, I think, with there's just so much detail to this. There's a fellow who wrote an article at a website called Metafilm, and it's called Ears Wide Shut. And in it, he's talking about his belief that Eyes Wide Shut is about a cabal that moves from place to place in history, and it moves across the globe from east to west. And it starts out in Venice, and then it goes up to Vienna, and then it goes into Paris, then London, and then New York. So this cabal, presumably, as it's illustrated in Eyes Wide Shut, is of the House of Orange, right? It's moving across the world like the sun moves across the sky from east to west, okay? And now, so we have this idea then of the sun representing the House of Orange, but the connection to the UK is that it's a Protestant nation, right? Now, Holland, of course, features the color orange as part of their flag, and that's where Martin Luther is from, of course, right? Martin Luther is the man who created the concept of anti-Catholicism. So what I'm seeing here, essentially, is a war, a very long war between Protestant and Catholic forces, essentially. And I'm not necessarily implying that on the level of a direct conspiracy, but although I think that that's there, quite frankly, is that there, and I believe, and this all goes back into Napoleon, too. We know that Kubrick was obsessed with Napoleon. And Kubrick tended to be obsessed with things that he hated, basically. He hated Hitler, and he hated Napoleon. He gets as close as he can to debunking Napoleon in Barry Lyndon, essentially. Although it's set at a different time. But I hope you guys are following what I'm saying here, is that essentially Kubrick, living in the UK at Milton Keynes, another MK, is essentially representative of the forces of Protestantism in some way, representative of the House of Orange, of A Clockwork Orange, and finally of a single world system of government, basically, that would emanate out of the UK. So that's what I'm getting from all this.
I want to contribute something really quick here. So I was looking up, trying to look at the date of Barry Lyndon when it was released, and there was this Russian scientist named Theodosius Dobzhansky who died on that day and year, who was like, he contributed to this thing, the statement of the race question, which influenced our understanding of genetics in terms of race after World War II. And what was I just looking at? So his work was instrumental in spreading the idea that it is through mutations in genes that natural selection takes place. This guy was like a super bigwig from Russia. I don't know. I thought that was kind of interesting. It's something for Barry Lyndon.
I think that's great. And actually, if all of you wouldn't mind, if any of you come up with things that are missed here, please just send me an email or Alan an email, and we'll add it to the list. There it is. Cool. Continue, please.
Yeah, this idea of like some sort of weird, almost like caste, I think Mark's sort of positing this as some sort of war between, you know, the elites and stuff, or we have the idea of the colonization. We have all this really crazy run-through stuff with American Indian imagery. So we have these, like, genocides upon genocide and things like that. I think it's really fascinating that it's essentially the same idea. And we see this, I think it's so interesting, like, this is a kind of obvious one, but we have with, which is, I'm trying to find, okay, with the killing, and we have Elvis Presley singing Heartbreak Hotel, and we take this to The Shining, you know, the idea of it being the Heartbreak Hotel, where Operation Red Wing, we have the Operation Red Wing, the hydrogen bomb, again, World War II, but also American Indians, and the death of Hitler's half-brother. This brings up things that were mentioned in the Room 237 documentary, the idea that somehow The Shining both encodes the Nazi genocide, but also the colonial genocide. And you see both of those representative right next to Heartbreak Hotel is pretty fascinating.
And for a student of the Holocaust, like Kubrick, he would have known that Hitler got his, you know, took a lot of his plans for genocide and for concentration camps directly out of the U.S. treatment of the Native Americans here. So when they said that in the film, it was like, why, this is not an either or. If you pay attention to one Holocaust and know that it was inspired by another one, and the one that inspired it came from your home, you're going, you know, and then if you make a movie about one, you can't make a movie, you know, in America, you're going to make a movie about both if you're doing it on the level of metaphor. So I just thought that was really interesting. I wanted also throughout there, I've been reading a Kubrick biography, and I don't know if anyone is aware of this, but I found an amazing sink for his family, which is that his family came to America, his grandfather or great-grandfather, I'm not sure, but his grandfather, arrived in America on December 27th, 1899, on the Lusitania.
Ah, really?
Yes.
That's crazy. Wow, okay. Especially, there's the book Secret Agent 666, which will enlighten the significance of that as well.
Really? Tell more.
There's a book that shows, it's really, really well done, and everything's well referenced, showing how Crowley was involved with the sinking of the Lusitania, getting both the British and the U.S. involved in World War I, and how it was strategized. And so that became the groundwork. The book doesn't go into this, but this is the implication, if you read it, is that that became like the format that we use for false flag terrorism ever since. Like, we pretty much figured out the formula for getting people's support in a war through the Lusitania specifically. So, yeah.
And that's the thing is, for me, with thinking of a young Stanley Kubrick, like, when having that be part of his story, his family story, that it's like, I was talking with Alan about this. It's like if you had been on the Titanic and then you heard the Titanic sank and you remembered it's like you have a totally different experience, like being in if you've been in the World Trade Center, or if you haven't, at any time in your life, you feel like you kind of are a survivor in a weird way. And there's there's this strange survivor theme that's running through Kubrick. You know, his family survived the Lusitania. As a child, you got to think like that. And he's also a survivor of the Holocaust. As a Jewish kid in Brooklyn learning about this, you can't help but feel like it's more personal. And when I saw the Lusitania, I was like, well, of course, this is a kid who's growing up personalizing world events.
Yeah, the thing that got him initially recognized was one photograph that he took of a guy at a newspaper stand with his face down looking at the newspaper of war, you know, and he's like traumatized by it. He's tripping out on it. And that was what really brought Kubrick to his initial fame as a young person. That's how he ended up being the youngest director ever to live. He took these photographs that were just incredible.
I just want to take the opportunity here. We now have John Fell Ryan on the line. I just want to welcome him into the call. If there's anything you want to add here, John, I assume you got the... I know you came in after we sort of read through it, but if you saw the list already, I'm curious if you have any input here.
Yeah, I read through the list last night. Sorry, my daylight savings time threw me off.
Ha. It's the white man fucking with the red man's timetable. Oh my God, I just said that. Of course,
it's all about it.
The Yanks and Reds is not just the communists, but of course, the red man. Yeah. Oh my God, I'm an idiot. I just realized that right now. Yeah.
Communism is just a red herring.
Yeah, exactly.
So I had something that blew my mind the other day while studying, where there's a Kabbalistic reference from the 16th century to the Iron Curtain, where it's talking about the, like, it's looking at Genesis, and it was talking about the green line that spread throughout the world that's like a spiral that keeps everything in a certain order after the fall in the garden and what that's symbolic of. But it described the basically the, whatever you want to call it, the light or the spiritual essence of things being surrounded by this coating. And the coating is actually referred to as an iron curtain. And so I don't know, that just kind of tripped me out. I felt that's it was worth
incredible.
I don't know.
Well, I would say that that iron curtain is the moon, essentially. Probably the interior limit of the moon.
Well, that's exactly what it says. Because it has the whole thing about the demuning of the moon and the cycles of the moon and why it is that Eve is, like, she experiences pain with childbirth. It's also, it's all symbolic, of course, but it's expressing that the menstruation cycle in relationship to the moon, that it's a cycle that goes into place that didn't exist in the same way before that.
This is why the doors and the Shining open up and the blood pours out, if this is the menstrual symbolism.
And it's the Iron Curtain as well, Alan, because iron is in the blood, right?
Yes, yeah, I like that. I like that.
The blood has it, the flavor of blood is iron, essentially. So that's the best taste that you notice.
It works in so many levels.
That the curtain in the Holy of Holies that surrounds the Ark of the Covenant is actually meant to symbolically represent snake skin, and that the skin of the snake in the garden is actually the Torah itself, which is why the value of Nahash, serpent, is the same value as Messiah, because the Redeemer is actually the same one who caused the illusion in the first place, that it's an infinite cycle or whatever. It's just crazy. Like, this book took... You know, 400 years to publish because of people being offended by stuff like this. But
David, if you have any way of putting any of that online, even a snippet of it, I'd be very interested to see it.
Yeah, I'm writing down that whole commentary on the Zohar. So I have been.
But I think this is interesting because this works on so many levels. You have the idea of the one who creates the illusion being the Redeemer. There's your really original false flag terrorism, right? You know, I'm going to create the, you know, order out of chaos and stuff like that. But there's your, also, we've talked about the idea of the Iron Curtain. Iron in alchemy, iron being the same thing as Mars, or Mars, the god of war. So when you say the Iron Curtain, you're saying the war curtain. Mars is affiliated with Gevura, with severity. It's the color red. So what's being kept in place, you're holding the reds in place with your iron or Martian curtain.
Right. So this is the thing with the – there's two verses that occur side by side where it says Adam and Eve were naked and were not ashamed, and then it introduces a serpent, which was the most cunning of all the creatures in the garden. The word for cunning is the same word for naked. So Aram means both. And so you have this idea for something to be exposed, which is to be naked, is the same thing as for something to be concealed, as in, you know, cunning. To be cunning is to hide something. But it's the meaning here is taken by Kabbalists to be all things are in plain sight. And anything that stands between you and the truth is just an illusion, which is being referred to here as an iron curtain. So, yeah. It's just like pictures in a book, Danny.
So what's the silver screen compared to the Iron Curtain? Some sort of artistic compromise or some second cousin or...
I think it's our own reflection. And it's our like, that's the whole point of what's being attempted to be expressed in terms of psychology, especially in what Kubrick brings to the table, is just deeper and deeper reflection. It's like the singular eye of Hal is just showing, like, reflecting back to us everything except our essence. It's just all the levels of our being before our soul, you know?
John, pretty heavy, man. John, this thing you just put up, this link, seeing, that's incredible when you compare those two shots of Jack entering the Heartbreak Hotel. And, you know, one could, I guess, theoretically argue that that was, okay, we're, you know, covering that shot because we're not filming that today, but there's no way Kubrick would have left that in there. So that black curtain now covering that area is pretty incredible from one shot to the next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's neatly tucked behind the radiator there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like bolted into the wall, so it's, and it's 12 feet tall.
And I like, here's the red man guarding the red pillar.
Yeah, and the woman in white, like walking by, and she's also in the first scene there, like sitting down in the chair. And though I missed it while writing the article.
That's
When he walks in, she turns around like 180 degrees and looks directly into the camera.
Mm. That's really an insane detail to find, John.
Yeah.
Because I didn't get it, I've looked at your post and I've tried to, like, I was like, where does he see this curtain? And only now did I put together that there's that room between the lamp and there should be a white painted wall. I don't know. I couldn't even see it even when you put it right there in front of my face. So I'm just astounded by that one.
Yeah, that little is really weird because it changes dimensions every time you see it. Like, it's just another one of the weird changing rooms.
So where it says the entrance, the first photo, is that Stephen King or am I totally tripping? Sitting on the chair, it's the first shot of The Shining after the going to the Sun Road.
I don't think it
looks like. Oh, it totally looks like it. It's hilarious,
dude. In the theater, and I'm sitting up close in the theater, and I'm like Stephen King, and then it only is 1 second, you know. But I swear, dude, it looks like Stephen King looked in the fucking early 80s. Sorry,
except that he has gray hair.
What's that?
It's almost as if Kubrick is locking him into the Overlook as well, because it would be a much older looking Stephen King though. That at the time, in the mid 70s, Stephen King would have been, you know, a lot thinner than that, and also his hair was brown, not gray. So
okay.
It's just so he's putting an older Stephen King in there as if to say, you know, you're coming into my world, and I think that's proven true in regards to the idea of how the book has been completely co-opted.
And I think the most prominent skeleton that Wendy sees later in the movie is if you had Stephen King without any flesh, I'm sure it would be a dead ringer.
I wanted to add something to the whole Mars idea. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, wait. Before you do, I just wanted to share one. There, in this Kubrick book I'm reading, there's a quote from Stephen King about The Shining or about Kubrick, which is, I think is really, you guys will get a kick out of. Stephen King says, he's kind of a dyspeptic filmmaker, a type A filmmaker, worrying and wanting to edit right up to the end. He's very painstaking, obviously. You know what? I think he wants to hurt people with this movie. I think he really wants to make a movie that will hurt people.
Yes, I agree with that completely. I think that Stanley Kubrick was a very mean-spirited, nasty son of a bitch. And I think that's inherently obvious in his films as you get, and it's a gift. That's what it is. It's a gift if you want it, essentially.
Well, if you're the kind of person who focuses a lot of your attention on things you hate, then if you are a mean-spirited son of a bitch, that kind of makes you a hero.
Yes, well, in a sense, because there's a duality there that can't be escaped, essentially. You know, when you talk about what he has given to the world in terms of art, it's on par with Leonardo da Vinci. There's no other filmmaker that even comes remotely close to Stanley Kubrick. And that's an important reason why he's important to study in terms of Sync too. Because when you're looking at a Kubrick film, just the film itself, and I know that this is John's philosophy, basically, you know, you just look at the damn movie and just keep looking at it. When you're looking at the film, Oh, I forgot what I was going to say there. What was my point? Somebody remind me.
You'll find it.
About the inherent duality of being a mean-spirited son of a bitch who focuses on meaner-spirited sons of bitches who have more power and the actual, like, who aren't artists, who are, you know, the Napoleons, the Hitlers, the
general. The point that I was going to make was why Kubrick is interesting in terms of sync. That's right. That's what I forgot. And to make a short story of it, essentially, when you have somebody who's taking this kind of making this kind of attention to extremely obscure detail, and on so many levels, so like the metaphor alone, I believe strongly that Kubrick was vastly aware of this when he's making his films. So, and if you hear the accounts of the films being made, it starts to make sense. His attention to detail starts to make sense only if you understand that he was extremely aware of every potential layer of metaphor when he's making the film. So when you're looking at this in terms of sync, what you're studying is something that was done on purpose almost certainly in every way when you're looking at the film.
Although that's what I think is interesting about the date lists, that Alan sort of set this in motion with noticing the date syncs, is that that's something he, like, even, I guess what I think is that when you're working in that level of mastery, syncs will accrue even where it's unconscious, because there's no way that that date in 1951 when Day of the Fight came out is so rich. You can extrapolate, you know, the whole history after the fact. You can look back and see it's all encoded there in something that he had no control over.
Well, I don't know if I agree with it. See, this is the thing, is that, and I know that Bill is familiar with this about my theories about Kubrick. I think everybody else on the panel is probably familiar with my theories in this regard, except for you, Andres. We've never spoken before, but I basically conflate the intelligence of Kubrick with the planet Saturn. And in this sense, Saturn is the time being, right? I think that Kubrick is literally tapped into this intelligence, that he's and there are so many reasons to believe this. I mean, it's a wackadoodle idea, I know, but essentially, that's what I think, is that the mind of Kubrick is the mind of Saturn, one and the same, basically. And I'm not the only one out there who thinks this. There's another guy doing extraordinary research right now, and it is extraordinary. It has to be read, and it's called crypto-kubrology. You can search it on Google.
So you think that Kubrick is both the surfer and the wave?
Yeah, I do, actually, yes. In the sense of a time-based illusion. I think that his intelligence, at the very least, it was completely dialed in to Saturnine phenomenon at some point very early on. You know, I'm pretty certain that there's other filmmakers who feel this way too. Who have recognized that Kubrick was a Saturnine phenomenon. Paul Thomas Anderson in particular has done this. There's a character in his film Magnolia, a kid called Stanley. And this kid is a super genius, basically. All he does is just sit and engorge himself on information all the time. And he's a little black-haired kid with big blue eyes, just like Stanley Kubrick. And in his recent film, The Master, Paul Thomas Anderson shows a character at a camera. And behind him, or the song that's playing, is called Get Thee Behind Me, Satan, essentially. And of course, Saturn and Satan are the same character. So, and this leads us back again to what we talked about at the very beginning, before John came by, about the idea of the Archon, or the Archons, and the control of our reality by some extremely... some kind of alien intelligence, essentially. So, you know, that's where I'm coming from, is that I think that Kubrick was dialed into this 100%. That's just my feeling of it.
You know, it's interesting, because if you take that, I know obviously Kubrick didn't make 2010, Year We Make Contact. So this is another thing that he wouldn't have had control over, but it's just interesting when you see in 2010 this sort of intelligences of the monoliths that say, you know, all of these planets are freed, you can do whatever the fuck you want, but don't touch Europa, that's ours. And that, of course, being like...
tree in the garden.
right. And what is, you know, it's like Europe is named after Europa. It's the same idea. So it's like, we own this shit. We're running House of Orange or, you know, all these different things. And it's like, this is ours. We got this on lockdown and you can do whatever the fuck you want elsewhere. It's just interesting. I don't know.
Here's one for Bill in regard to that is that Lars von Trier's film Europa about with Max von Sydow who's basically, oh man, he's like a psychiatrist who's like walking this guy through I wouldn't do it justice, but it's a World War II movie, but it's interesting because Bill had just brought up The Exorcist in relationship to Rosemary's Baby and some of the synchronicity surrounding that, and so you have the priest Max von Sydow in that film. There's an interesting connection there. Anyways, a little sidetrack.
I'll have to find that one.
So I think what I liked, is because I wouldn't have thought to do this, is like when you bring in these number one songs, this is where synchronicity lets in that you could argue that Stanley Kubrick was aware of that he's the master chess player. This is why I still hold the line that no matter how intelligent of a chess player you are, sync is not a chess game that where it's just here are the rules of chess. Sync is a chess game where you're playing outside and like a bird can shit on your chessboard or the wind can blow your man over or something like that. It's a thing where no matter how intelligent you are, there are other forces at play, which actually is the meaning of Saturnine energy. If you know different ideas of Saturn, Saturn is the forces of nature which you cannot overcome at any point. You know, you can become this enlightened master of blah blah blah, but there are certain built-in rules of the game that these are the forces of nature that cannot be controlled and that you have to learn to manage or deal with. And that is what Saturn is affiliated with.
But I think that's the message of Stanley Kubrick's films, too.
Right.
You can't get outside of the matrix of my intelligence. That's what he's saying in his movies. But
he's also showing a full potential. You could see it as that, and that's a fair argument. But I think also you could see it as, hey, these are the forces that we cannot overcome, but we can also reach a full potential in light of that. If we understand what the rules of the game are and what forces we can and cannot control, once we understand what we can control and understand what we can, look what amazing shit we can do. Is one way of also looking at it. Like, my thing is, when you see how high the moon and seeing how the moon is going to be run through all his stuff is just fucking incredible. How much is that doggy in the window? Is this like Stairway to Sirius? All this sort of stuff. St. George and the Dragon Net. This is, I've connected St. George as Horus with 9/11. You have Yellow Rose of Texas. I don't know, is that JFK getting shot? I don't fucking know. Heartbreak Hotel of the Overlook. April Love. David was pointing out these Athena connections. We have the Mr. Custer, again, our Indians. I think the sync of Ray Charles, I Can't Stop Loving You with Lolita. Like, I want to just do a fucking mashup. I want to do a mashup where you take, like, the most inappropriate 3 minutes and 19 seconds of Lolita and play Ray Charles's I Can't Stop Loving You over it. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, how funny would that be?
It's a great idea.
Same thing. Like, you have, Otis Redding sitting on the dock of the bay with 2001 A Space Odyssey. Like, the fucking docking bay. That's the fucking poster is the docking bay. But the other one I want to play with is...
And what's he doing? He's wasting time.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a great, great call. But he's also, Otis Redding is also the star man because Otis Redding never got to see that he, a number one hit for himself. It was only shortly after he died that Sitting on the Dock of the Bay went number one. So he essentially is Dave Bowman. He doesn't become the star until after he dies, until he crosses the abyss. Do you know what I'm saying?
With the Ray Charles thing, it says, was Lolita rated X?
I see that poster. Yeah, it's interesting.
And I'm just
I don't think there were X ratings. They hadn't come up with the X rating.
Yeah, there weren't. The first X-rated film to get an Oscar was Midnight Cowboy, and that was the point at which Hollywood films became X-rated, that happened at all.
But like I'm
Before that, it was just there was the code. It either got past the code and was legal. It was either legal or illegal, basically. And it was a legal film.
The Catholic Church edited Lolita. They came out with the later edit later. So the first people who saw Lolita in the theater saw a cut where there were certain things that were taken out, like when he looks at the picture by the bed and just certain, and it was the Catholic Church would literally screen films and check if they were appropriate for the public before they could get distributed.
Again, I'm telling you, they want to jerry-rig his message, and that explains why he now later in his career. I think I'm not sure if this is unique only to The Shining, but he made different versions of films for different countries. Essentially, I mean, that's how deep into this guy was.
He knew the importance.
How
like Lenny Bruce poster being in what film was that, Andras?
Yeah, in The Killing. It shows up in the background of The Killing, like 3 or 4 years. Like it's 3 years before his first record. Like when he was, it's not a Lenny Bruce poster. It's a burlesque poster with Lenny Bruce's name as like, it says girls, 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 and Lenny Bruce. And it just is in the background of the shot. And maybe Kubrick probably was aware of Lenny Bruce. But was he aware that Lenny Bruce was going to be anything but a dirty nightclub comedian who some guys from New York knew about? No way. No way could he have known that. And when it shows up there, it's like this wink from the universe saying, you know, like that. It's just like this, that what I agree with the theory that, you know, Kubrick is the architect of it all. But I think it's sort of like we're all the architect of it all. And if you happen to be a master, you're going to attract to you like nobody's business. And that's what I think is happening with the Lenny Bruce thing and a lot of these, like these dates and these songs. That when you're that great and you're that cemented, I mean, his family came to he is the 20th century. They came to America on the eve of the 20th century on the Lusitania.
Stanley right. Kubrick That's, is I mean, the 20th century Fox, Fox being 666.
Yep. Clockwork Orange.
And I hold that Kubrick killed film, essentially, with Eyes Wide Shut. That movies essentially it came to an end in the 20th century, and that what we're now seeing aren't movies at all. And I was talking about this the last time with David and Bill about the idea of the position of the camera being everything to what makes a movie. And this is what gets lost with CGI, is that their camera isn't anywhere in those images, or it's everywhere, essentially. Like a and just to kind of drive this point home, one could not consider an animated film a film because there the camera has no position, essentially. There's nothing to be overcome with an animator in terms of what you want to show. You just have to draw it, essentially. But when you are making an actual movie, the camera has to be there, and it's a very important part of the dialectic of cinema. And many filmmakers comment on the concept of the camera in their work. It's a natural thing. Well, Kubrick has done this to what I think is an astonishing degree. And this goes back to the idea of the pyramid again and the eye on top of the pyramid. All right. If you were to bend down over a pyramid, if you were like, if you had a small pyramid, and it would be about, ironically, about the size of a hat, essentially. If you had a pyramid-sized hat or a hat-sized pyramid. And if you bend down over this pyramid and you put your eyeball right to the tip of the pyramid, that pyramid is going to completely fill your field of visual acuity. Everything is going to be pyramid. That's all you're going to see out of that eye with your eyeball right up to the tip. And this is the image of Bill Watson in The Shining, right? Bill Watson, when we see him, this mystery, what is this guy doing in this film exactly? Following everybody around. Well, that's because he is the camera. So again, he's what's on the bill, right?
Mm.
And in this case, it's the eye. It's represented by the eye looking forward as a camera, essentially. And of course, in that scene, there's a sign that reads "Camera Walk," right? So Bill Watson walks in the position of the camera that we will later see following Danny around, right? He lags slightly behind the group when walking through the Colorado room. And this is the level of, and to me that's just astonishing, basically, that he's calling in idea. So the idea of go ahead, Alan.
Mark, you started this off. You were showing this idea of this sort of like the pyramid, the Egyptian pyramid, perhaps being some sort of like vessel for archonic forces or something like that. And it's just interesting because whether it's you know, we of course bend what's literal and what's metaphor over and over and over again to a sort of breaking point here. But it's very much the metaphor is apt. Stanley Kubrick or any filmmaker, what does the camera do? It's almost like the ghost trap in Ghostbusters, right? It sucks all the light into it. It captures the light and puts it into a shadowy box. This is how a camera operates. Hey, I'm going to steal the light. I'm going to capture the light, put it in a dark box, and then impress it down into crude matter onto a film.
Which
is very much right. Like this is so he's the hierophant. You know, he's sucking that in and encapsulating it, capturing it. And this, of course, has a sort of nefarious concept to it because he's capturing the light and trapping it in the dark. I mean, you know, this is whether or not that reflects some sort of nefarious nature within someone or within all filmmakers is an interesting thing to consider. But it's certainly the metaphor is definitely apt.
Well, when Andrus was going through his list, I was struck by the Mount St. Helen sink. And, consider this. The secret teaching of Scientology, not so secret anymore, is that Xenu, this overlord, who is essentially an archon, right? That's what he is, jammed a whole bunch of souls into the volcanoes of the world, or dropped them all into a volcano, basically. So that fits in, and of course the pyramid being a volcano as well. So that it actually fits in, interestingly, with Scientology. And just as a point of trivia, I don't know if you know this, but Kubrick's daughter, Vivienne, the one who made the documentary, The Making of The Shining, is a entrenched Scientologist. She doesn't speak to anybody in her family anymore, basically. So you might find that interesting.
Oh, absolutely. I've heard you speak about Vivienne and Scientology as it relates to Eyes Wide Shut before. What I think is interesting, you had done a post a long time ago, and what I'm still trying to wrap my head around your position here is that in a post you did about Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut being a sort of foreshadow or portent of 9/11, and of course we see this in The Shining as well, where Danny is horrified to watch. He puts his hands over his eyes, but he's still kind of peeking. It's like a train wreck. He can't look away. He's watching the falling of the twins over and over again, right?
Right, and it's just like pictures in a book,
just
implying
like
that there's something about the event of 9/11 that is not actually, that is faked, essentially.
Right, and now again, where's the metaphor end? So is it faked, meaning the whole thing is a side psyop from Tavistock, or is it the whole thing is fake because this is just an expression of our collective unconscious fears being projected into the holographic universe? You know, that this is, The Shining is an expression of all of us.
I would agree with that. I mean, I don't have a problem with the idea that these occurrences represent a force of nature, as you put it yourself. That's what it is. But to me, it's less exciting to talk about it in that kind of way, because I like to get down to, what I consider to be the more ugly truths about this, because
it's sort of like film. It's like sort of like what we're doing with the Sink film criticism is like you can. It works on so many multiple levels. It's like, you know, it's like saying, is the Shining the German Holocaust or the colonial Holocaust? And as Andras rightly points out, it's the same fucking thing. So when we say like, is 9/11 and, you know, an illusion, a fakery on the scale, on a geopolitical scale? Yes, it is. But is it an illusion and fakery on a psychic, you know, universal level? The answer is yes. It's somehow true on multiple levels, just like any good Kubrick film would be.
We kind of came
or just
to that,
like any moment in life is like that. That's it's just when everyone's focusing on something that's big, it gets bigger. And it creates a context, but that's to me that's the major lesson of Sink. And I'm sorry, I just jumped in and interrupted.
No,
but
fine.
It is that thing that it's there in every moment. Like when I was making this list, I took out there were a bunch of personal sinks for me, people who were born on these dates. My personal connection with Mount St. Helens or that, you know, and that eruption or different things that are, that again, are these, when you start to unpack Sink, you get the whole tree. You get everything from matter to light and everything in between through that a Sink expresses or that great art expresses. And when you have the Sink between great art and Sinks and history, crazy shit happens. You know, and we can refract that light through so many different points of view on it. Like whether he's the surfer and the wave, or whether he's the wave, or whether he's the surfer, or whether that's not even an apt metaphor. Those are all in play when we're doing this kind of criticism of this kind of artist. Are there anti-sinks? Yeah.
There's like the idea that the great work itself is literally to be moving in sync, and for one to be aware of the universal underlying like template of archetypes, and to be presenting what can be universally applied, like the I Ching, like that's what the great work is. And so in that way, it could be argued that Kubrick doesn't have to be aware of every place that something applies, just recognizing how it applies, and then just emphasizing those archetypal nodes.